Exception number 6820, rule number 2.
Mr. McKenzie, reel 2.
The posts here were Sanger type, but built up of logs and anything that one could get to stop a rush. They were surrounded by very flimsy wire and, of course, were inside a wood, the end of the Tiergarten Wood.
Now, you mentioned Maisier Le Metz. How did you get on with the local population there? Did they seem to be any different from the rest of the French?
They, of course, that area had been, after the Franco-Prussian War, had been more or less ceded to the Germans by the French. Their language was mainly German, I discovered, when we got there. And for the short time we were there, they didn't seem hostile, but they didn't seem very friendly either. And the fact that German was the language mainly used made us very suspicious. They had a big blast furnace there, and I was entertained by one of the directors one evening. I don't know whether he was actually trying to pump my friend and I for information about our trip, but he did treat us very well and produced a bottle of champagne.
Do you think those suspicions were justified or unjustified?
I'm not quite certain about that. One can have two minds. One of my own men in captivity had friendly letters from there throughout his share of the captivity. The people who were the owners of the billets that we were in, my platoon was in, they seemed fairly friendly, but just above the sofa that I'd managed to get as a bed, there was a photograph of the 1418 war period of a section in German uniform, and right in the centre was the present owner of the house in Pickelhaub and German uniform. However, we got on quite well with the family. Didn't have anything very special to do with them, but they weren't hostile.
Can you tell me some more about the positions you took up in the Maginot Line?
The Maginot proper, this position we took up, first of all, was from the French. We had a company position at the end of a wood on a ridge within about 500 yards of the German border, the frontier there, which was at the bottom of a valley. There was about 19 posts, I think, either built up Sanger type or dug in. There's a couple of positions there dug in. We had a position for a mortar, to sight a mortar, and we had an artillery spotter post with us. It was occupied by two platoons of my company, under Major Murray, Major G.P. Murray of the Seaforth, who commanded the company. Our third platoon under Sergeant McIntosh had been lent to B Company. Now, so far as I could see, we were out in a position which was quite fluid, could be moved back very quickly, and I was mainly there to stop a rush. We were 13 kilometres in front of the Lane Maginot proper.
Did you say it was a notorious spotter post?
Pardon?
Did you say the spotter post was notorious?
No, it was one of our positions. The spotter, it's an observation post, an OP.
What impression did you get of the French troops whom you relieved?
Well, looking back, they were a pretty poor lot. But they were naturally very friendly to us. I was in the position one night before my company. I had to take over a certain area there. I and another sergeant of the C Company and the company commander. But they were hospitable, quite friendly. They'd heard a lot about what we were supposed to be doing to their wives, but they didn't show any great hostility. But apparently the Jerry had been throwing over shells filled up with information about what Tommy was doing to the French ladies back in the billet there. Well, the French soldier, he was having to fight the war for them. Still, our appearance in the Maginot helped to go against that particular libel.
Did the French troops comment on this rumour that was going about?
To me, I knew a little bit of French. They mentioned it, that they'd had these pamphlets, tracks and so on, bunged over with the mortars, and naturally they were suspicious, I should think, but they weren't hostile in any way that I ever discovered. And of course, the fact that we were coming to relieve them made them quite happy to see us.
Did they treat the propaganda as a joke at all?
Well, I don't really know. Propaganda is insidious, especially when you are at the front and it's directed against the individuals who are having a cushy time in the rear.
Was it true that British troops were getting off with French women?
I don't think so, not to any great extent. I had made very, very good friends in Halloran there, and they are my friends today, many years afterwards. But, of course, there's always that suspicion. The soldier in France, or what was worse, the soldier in captivity in Poland, was regaled by propaganda from the Germans about what the Free French were doing in Britain, and the Yanks when they came along. We took it with a grain of salt.
In what way did you consider the French troops to be poor?
Well, they soldiers that were out in France, first of all, were both professionals. The next lot were territorials, who were all volunteers. They're called Saturday night soldiers, but amongst the 51st Division. They had a famous name to keep up. And the odd French soldier here and there, one discovered a really brilliant type of fighting man, but they seemed very few and far between. They certainly didn't have their heart on it. And I know from conversation I had previously with civilians that they did not think it was worthwhile they're going to fight anybody.
Which individuals were these?
People that I came in contact with as caterer to the officers' mess, people who were, had breweries where I had to go and get beer and such like, tradespeople of some rank, and the general opinion is particularly in northern France. For instance, Halloween was called Halloween le Rouge, the red Halloween, which was had got a communist mayor and was very strongly communistic. And of course, in the early days of the war, it was a capitalist war against the communists. This was the propaganda that was put about as much as Jerry could push it. That's my opinion, of course. And it turned out that for quite some time after the breakthrough, we were to suffer from this effect, that the average Frenchman, he'd been betrayed by everybody that should have known better. They should never have been in the war. That was the early days. And I found, I don't know if I'm going on too far, but they found that what they'd been told about the German soldier, it was all wrong. He was a very correct individual at the commencement, at the start, when they came through, apart from SS, which are, strictly speaking, a special type of soldier. The ordinary Wehrmacht, they were good soldiers and obeyed orders and did not molest the civilian population to any great extent. This was the opinion in the early days after the Germans had completed their entry into France and booted us out.
Now, coming back to the experiences that you had in the Maginot Line, can you tell me a little bit about them, about the operations which you conducted?
The operations, well, it was simply in the first, or petty posts, as they called them, a series of loosely connected positions in woods, on ridges, and just cover for any to be held rather on a temporary basis for any determined attack by German armour. We held the position for the first 8 days, moved out to the Franche Caserne, which was the upstairs billet for the fortress troops who manned the Maginot proper. We spent the first night cleaning up and sorting out our kit in Franche Caserne. And during the night, of course, the breakthrough came. That was the 9th, 10th of June, 1940. And we were smartly moved out from Franche Caserne to dig positions between the forts of the Maginot, about 1.5 to 2 kilometres behind the Farange Caserne. We were there for several days and then moved forward again to take over positions held by another regiment of the brigade in what was called then the Linde Recoil, the Line of Recoil. Now,
before we go on to the German attack in detail, can we talk a little bit about what happened as far as patrolling and so on was concerned before the German attack? Was there any sense in the Maginot Line before May the 10th of some sort of tacit agreement between the French and the Germans not to heat up the hostilities too much?
Well, so far as tacit agreements are concerned, the one that stuck out most of all was that people could move about in parties of less than six without getting fired on. Going above that number, of course, there was bound to be some sort of reprisal from the opposite side. Also, the fact that they allowed up two ration trucks to the nearest village to come through, and they had stated times, as far as I can remember, 10 and 4, to be there, otherwise they would be fired on. They arrived at a different time, they were allowed in. That was one of the peculiar things about that particular war. The men on the French side, they seem to have got used to the idea of doing as little as they possibly could to annoy the enemy on the other side. Never used their automatics. They very, very seldom apparently used the mortar. It was a weapon hated by the other side, so they didn't use that. And they seemed to be imbued with a sort of an anti-hostile spirit.
Were the Germans also acting with restraint?
The German activity, the only German activity we saw was, of course, the movement of the patrols. You would see the occasional German police dog coming tearing along. They used those, and they came in with their light automatics, like machine pistols, and would pepper your position from behind a tree at a distance. They moved very quietly. They were very, very good at the job. But so far as any attacks were concerned, not until right up at the end was there any sort of concerted attack that I could discover. Not in our sector, in any case, which was the sector held by the 152 Brigade of the 51st Home Division.
Did the Germans use mortars before May the 10th?
I never had experience of mortar fire as such. We had some shell fire at a later period, when we moved up from Farange Caserne and took over the position held by another regiment of the brigade. And later we were ordered to evacuate that whole area and move back behind that Maginot proper.
Whilst you were in the Maginot Line before the German attack, did you see any casualties take place?
From my company, we were fortunate in having only one casualty in the whole time we were in the Maginot Line. and that was caused by a man failing, a man of arrangement, failing to answer a challenge at night when he got out of his position, and he was shot by his platoon sergeant after failing to answer a challenge. Otherwise, we were remarkably free of casualties.
Did you see the Germans take any casualties?
We saw very little of the Germans in any shape or form. The odd one outside his own particular slit trench on the ridge facing us, which was in Germany proper, just beyond about 500, 600 yards away. But I don't know that any casualties at all were there. I didn't actually see any POWs from their side in the vicinity at that time.
Was there any attempt to snatch prisoners on either side?
I think there was attempts on several occasions. We had a fighting patrol which made quite a good name for itself by going out and doing these fighting patrols. And it was commanded by a very famous individual, at least he's famous now, that's Chandos Blair. He was one of the youngest lieutenants in the regiment. He volunteered, so far as I know, to command the regimental fighting patrol and made quite a name for himself. He has recently retired from the job of Colonel of the Regiment. Chandos Blair. He's the man who went out fairly recently to talk to Idi Amin.
Did all the French units have this attitude of wanting to keep the fighting down, or were there any French units who were an exception?
Well, you call them a French unit, the very famous Légion d'Étrangers, the Foreign Legion, they made themselves very unpopular with their brethren by wanting to fire anything that was remotely hostile. Incidentally, the Foreign Legion position was next door to the one that we were in, and clear on top of a ridge.
What impression did you get of the French Foreign Legion?
The French Foreign Legion, of course, they had their name to keep up. They were quite a swaggering lot. And, of course, they were of all nationalities.
How were they swaggering?
There is something typical of the Legion. I think they are trained to swagger.
But how did it show itself?
Well, cocksureness in their own professionalism, if you like. It's very difficult to explain, but if you ever pick up any book or story of the Legion, it's there, and it goes right through to a very famous exploit of theirs in Mexico at Cameroon. I don't know if you have heard of that exploit, where the remains of a unit just fought right through to the last man against an overwhelming force of Mexicans. It's a famous day with the Legion, Cameroon.
Now, can we go on to the actual German attack on May the 10th, and can you tell me what you remember of that day as far as it affected you personally?
The 10th of May, as soon as we got out We were roused out of it quite early in the morning. Most people had been awake all night because of the tremendous amount of gunfire that had been going along the forts. And we moved, first of all, rearwards to complete unfinished French rifle positions, which we did for 2 or 3 days. Then we were sent forward again to take over the positions held by another unit of the regiment, the 4th Seaforce, who went temporarily forward for possibly 3 days until there was a general withdrawal ordered. They moved from their positions to the rear of the ones that they formerly held, leaving us in what was now known as the no man's land. The job we had there was to hold that position as long as we could, and till we received orders to withdraw behind the Maginot, which did come, and we're under the code word of Thistle. We moved back through Farange Caserne to a holding position very close at hand, where we were taken by army troop carrying lorries, right back about 40, 60 kilometres behind Metz, to a place called Jarnay.
What was it like there?
There, it was a very, very temporary halt. We expected to have a rest there, but it wasn't to be. We had a day there sorting out our kit and repacking our fighting wagons and getting cleaned up. The same day, we were ordered back aboard buses, a French convoy of buses, and moved off about 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night.
Did the German attack on May the 10th seem to be very determined on the Maginot Line?
No. There was no evidence of the German attack at all there, apart from increased aerial activity over that sector and a lot of shelling.
Was the aerial activity combative or reconnaissance?
Mainly our fighter planes chasing Jerry bombers back over the frontier. What we saw of it, the Germans had, of course, on the night of the 9th, 10th, they'd bombed everywhere that they knew of, on the French side, the Belgian side, into Holland. But we heard of it, we didn't see that. We saw during the days that followed a lot of returning Jerry bombers being chased by our own planes.
Did you see many bombs drop?
No. Not at that time.
Now, you said that you moved off from Jarnay. Where did you move to?
We moved off all night long through Verdun and then westward to the scene of the original breakthrough at Sedan, the French Ardennes.
What was the scene there?
We were put off our buses in the early hours of the morning. And as I got recounted, we were given a grandstand view of the fighting that was going on in the distance. Now, the reason we were there, one regiment of the 51st Division was simply in support of an effort the French were making to plug a hole in the breakthrough at the Sedan, the original breakthrough. And we, as I say, had a grandstand view of it. We cleaned up and we managed to get a couple of meals going there. And so the French troops, who were really good troops at that time, I have made some disparaging remarks about French troops as a whole, but these were the famous Blue Devils, Chasseurs Alpins. They were a motorised group.